This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
In light of increasing global conflicts like the ongoing battle in Syria and the lack of action from the United Nations, critics have argued that the Security Council is in need of reform in order to stay relevant. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think, let's say that at working level, there are a lot of UN agencies that are trying to do essential operations. They're trying to get aid into all areas of Syria, but especially the areas that have been besieged by the Assad regime and its allies, including the Russians. They have tried to get some type of halt to the military operations with their own attempts at a political resolution at working level. But the point is that as long as you have the Russians able to impose the veto in the Security Council, and indeed as long as China has that power, as long as you don't say, all right, we'll do something which does not need Security Council support, nothing will happen. You know, since 2011, the Russians have repeatedly vetoed any UN resolution which would have led to a meaningful ceasefire, which would have led to a transitional government, which would have led to humanitarian aid to all groups, not just to regime areas. And only 2 weeks ago, the Russians blocked a UN resolution for a ceasefire in Aleppo, just so military operations could continue. We need to be honest about this. As long as you have a small group of countries that can say no to any effective UN action, the organization is powerless. When you have Russia and the Assad regime in September bombing a UN convoy that was trying to get aid to Aleppo City because the Russians and the Assad regime didn't want the siege to be lifted, you've reached the limit of any type of effectiveness.
This also means that relevant governments have to step up. With that being said, is there anything governments can do to affect change or to put pressure on those who are responsible for the attacks?
Oh, yes. I mean, there was an option which was there since 2012. So we're talking 4.5 years ago, which was for protected areas for civilians. And this was in the context that the Assad regime was losing the battle on the ground. I mean, the Syrian army has effectively been depleted since 2012. And so the only thing that it had really to prevent collapse was just massive bombing of Syrian territory, including cities, beginning with the city of Homs. And what they would do is just simply would wipe out thousands of civilians, as well as just leveling these areas to be able to turn the military tide. Now, when you see that happening, you have to say, look, there have to be safe areas where people can not get bombed. Because until you do that, you will not have political talks. Because the Assad regime is not going to enter those talks, because they'll just keep bombing. And the opposition and the rebels will not enter the talks because they're being under this constant threat. But American officials such as Hillary Clinton, David Petraeus proposed this in 2012. President Obama vetoed it. He vetoed the idea of safe zones again in 2013 after the Assad regime's chemical weapons attacks. The British Parliament voted against safe zones in the summer of 2013. So in that context, there was no effective international action. Because it can't just be one government that does this. If it's just one government that does it, it looks like a unilateral intervention, and that isn't going to work. You have to have an agreement between a number of different countries, and you have to have an agreement that is not seen as being just simply for regime change. You can't just simply use this pretext to overthrow Assad. We never got to that point, and we still are not at that point.
Is it possible to propose those safe zones again in Syria?
We still could do this. I mean, we could declare a protected area in Idlib province where the opposition is in control. The Turks have effectively established a safe zone in parts of Aleppo province through their military intervention. It just needs international, basically, development of that. Say, okay, fine. We're going to make sure that the Turks and the rebels are not attacked in that area and that civilians, more importantly, are not attacked. But you just have seen an international community that time and again has not made that difficult decision, in part because they fear that a protected area will lead to just more military conflict, which I think is misguided, and in part because they have simply not been willing to take on the Russians.
Analysts say that not all governments should be put to blame for these attacks. Rather, they should put pressure on the Russian government instead. Is this a fair statement?
First and foremost, if you're going to have any type of responsible voice in international affairs, if you're going to have any type of authority which is based on values as well as geopolitics, you've got to condemn the mass killing of civilians by any side in the conflict. It just so happens that more than 90% of civilians in Syria since the autumn of 2015 have been killed by Russia and the Assad regime. Now, the question then is, all right, fine, you've condemned the attacks. What do you do next? You can basically call on the Assad regime to stop the attacks. But if you're going to press the Assad regime to stop the attacks, you have also got to get its allies to accept that limitation. So there should have been a meaningful line drawn with Russia and Iran years ago, because they're the essential backers of the Assad regime. You continue to draw that line. The problem right now is that a lot of people in the United States, including former government officials, including analysts, are saying, we have to cooperate with Russia. And indeed, that is what Secretary of State John Kerry has been doing for years. If you just simply cooperate with Russia, you are doing so on Moscow's terms. They will cooperate with you only if they see it being what they want. So you have to draw a line with the Russians first and foremost and say, before we engage in this cooperation, here are the terms. That's never been done.
Now, as important as possession of Aleppo is, it is still only one front in one war. Syria has undergone prolonged violence and several different conflicts over the past 6 years. That being said, why is so much attention focused on Aleppo now?
First of all, I think your initial point is a very important one, and that is the end of military operations in Aleppo. The reoccupation of all of that city by pro-Assad forces is just the end of a chapter in the Syrian conflict. It is not the end of the conflict itself. The Assad regime, propped up by its allies, still has less than a quarter of Syrian territory. Now, it happens to be the most populated areas of Syria, so that should be noted as well. But still, there are parts of the country that are controlled by the opposition and rebels, including, as we've mentioned, almost the entirety of Idlib province in the northwest. There is part of the country that is effectively controlled by Syrian Kurdish factions, especially much of the northeast of the country. There is part of the country which still has an Islamic State presence, including the city of Palmyra, which the Islamic State recaptured from the regime just over 2 weeks ago. So this is a fractured country. It's a fragmented country. Why Aleppo was significant is that you could never get a short-term partition of Syria while Aleppo was divided, because no one was going to accept a partition of the country where Aleppo was shared between the opposition and the regime. It just wasn't stable. Now that Aleppo is nominally in the hands of the regime, supported by Russia and Iran and Hezbollah as well, you have the space for that partition if that's the way that, as we mentioned, the Russians want to go, if that's the way that the Iranians can be persuaded to go.
So what happens next? How can we properly resolve the situation in Aleppo as well as in Syria as a whole?
We really have to look at ways to end the atrocities. Now, the large majority of atrocities have been on the regime side. Again, let me be clear. But there are issues, of course, of killing of civilians, which have been carried out by other groups in the conflict. The Islamic State, of course, the jihadist faction of Jabhat al-Nusra has committed abuses. So you have to look at going into these areas, and you have to try to support people who are trying to rebuild civil society. Now, I don't think that's really possible in the Assad regime's area, because President Assad is not really concerned about civil society. He's concerned about holding on to power. But I think in areas where the Kurds are in control and where the opposition and rebels are in control, you have to begin to have discussions, which is, how do you provide for transport? How do you provide for electricity? How do you provide for provision of food? And how do you provide for local governance, which has an effective judicial system, which has local councils that are supported by the population? In other words, you really have to back up your words that say you want a space that Syrians can not only live in, but that they can feel represented. That's why this uprising started. Mm-hmm. Syrians did not feel that the Assad regime represented them. They felt that the Assad regime abused them, that parliament was a puppet, that judicial system was merely simply to sanction their detention and torture. That's, I think, something that we're not talking about right now because we're still focused on Aleppo. But next year, it's something that if the short-term partition takes place, it's essential that we consider how this is to be done.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.